Mike, since this is, I guess, Bookworm was your idea here. we both came together here trying to, we both thought that we wanted to do a podcast together, and we knew we wanted to get together and talk, but we didn't know specifically what about. And then you posed this idea of Bookworm. So where did that come from?
It was basically an idea that I had based on what I knew of you and a lot of synergy with our approaches to how we work and how we look at life, I guess, where we're both trying to become better versions of ourselves. I'm putting words in your mouth, but I think that's pretty safe to say. And one of the things that I've been doing for a while is reading a lot, because that really helps me with my work over at Asian Efficiency. But I got the idea for a mini mastermind, basically, that we would record and release as a podcast, where we would read the same book and then we would kind of talk about what we got out of it, with the intention that that's going to help us synthesize what we're learning and then identify what action steps we can actually apply to our life from these books. So it's not just things that we crank through to check off a box on a to-do list and read a whole bunch of books and get a whole bunch of information that doesn't actually change anything, but actually produces tangible results in our lives as we chase awesome together, so to speak.
Yeah, and you and I, we've done a couple different recording sessions, one of which was on my podcast, one of which was on the Asian Efficiency podcast. And whenever you pose this idea of let's read a book and then let's talk about it, I love that idea. At the same time, my thought was, well, that means that we're reading a certain number of books at a certain number of days, and I'm not always the best at getting through those on in the time that I want to get through them. So from my standpoint, whenever we decided that we were going to go and we were going to read books at the same time and discuss them, my first thought was, great, it's finally, I guess, that motivator, that accountability that I was needing to read books. I've been a reader for a while, just not, I guess, regularly in the way that I want to be. So the idea of let's get together, let's read a book, and then let's do something with the words that we're reading. Because that's, to me, that's a piece that I've missed for a long time. Is I can read a book and then, like you're saying, let's check it off the list. Let's get the next one going and just keep running down the list. But it's not until, as we'll see with the book we're going to go through today, it's not until we actually make that decision on something to do with it that it really becomes real. Does that make sense, Mike?
Yep, absolutely. My pastor would say it this way, change isn't change until you change. So it doesn't matter all the facts that you collect. You have to actually, the rubber has to meet the road.
Right.
There has to be some manifestation of this stuff in your life before you actually are applying this and it's actually making a difference.
Yeah, it's so true. And some of this comes from our first book that we've now both read. And actually, this is a reread with a different version, but Getting Things Done by David Allen, just get it out there. The main crux of the book is do something with your ideas and have a system together on putting those ideas into action. And this is a book that I read, oh gosh, it's been 4 years ago, 3 years ago, somewhere in there. So from my standpoint, Mike, I got into GTD by not reading the book. So let's just get that out there as well. I started trying to put a lot of these systems together that David Allen talks about before even reading it. I was just trying to figure out how to get through certain things in corporate that I was in at the time and just really needed some help getting through that. And someone recommended Getting Things Done, and I picked it up and I read it in like 2 days and immediately destroyed every bit of organization that I had and started trying to implement it, failed miserably, and then rebuilt the whole system like 3 times. So it was quite the journey. But from your standpoint, how would you, like, what's the book about? What's the crux behind it from your viewpoint?
Getting Things Done is basically a organizational framework that you can use to free up your your cognitive resources is how David Allen would put it. And what that kind of means in layman's terms is that you don't have to constantly be worried about the things that you might be forgetting to do. He uses a really powerful analogy of emergency scan modality. It's kind of like a firefighter where you're constantly looking for the next fire to put out. And I think that resonates with a lot of people. Sounds like that resonated with you in the situation that you are in. That picture resonated with me when I read the book. And it provides the framework that you need to escape that. So he really clearly defines the problem, and then he provides a solution for a way out of that. And he breaks it down into 5 basic steps. And do you want to go through the steps right now?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think if we go through them, then it clears up a lot of the other stuff we're going to talk about.
Okay, sure. So the first one is capture, where you just basically have to get everything that's on your mind out of your mind. And once you have it all down, the second step is to clarify all that stuff. So you identify what these things are and where they're supposed to go in this system, which he's teaching you to establish so that you can actually trust that everything is where it's supposed to be and nothing's falling through the cracks. That's really the third step, I guess, is organize, where you're making sure that everything is in the appropriate container. The fourth step is to review. So once you have everything where it's supposed to be, you have to review it weekly at least, where you evaluate every single piece of the system. And ideally, you look at everything that's in there, at least at the project level, and say, is this something that I still want to be doing? But that's important because you can't just set it in your system and forget it. If you do that, it's not going to be very long until entropy kicks in, and then you've got this system that you can't trust anymore. And then the fifth step is engage, or in the previous version, it was called do. It's actually where you would do the work. And this is what most people try to skip straight to, is like, well, I don't even need to do any of that other stuff. I already know what I need to do. But the problem is you don't know everything that you need to do in addition to what you're supposed to be doing right now. And when you're done doing that thing that you know you need to do right now, you're going to be stuck thinking about, okay, what is the next step that I have to do in whatever project? And it's when you stop and think about those things, that little bit of friction, in my experience anyways, is the thing that keeps you from actually taking the next step and doing the next thing. And so it's really important. I think the key part to this system that really makes it work for me is that you clarify all this stuff on the front end so that when it comes time to actually do the work, you can just queue up the next thing. You have all the requirements right there and you can just crank it out. You can actually do the work really quickly, really efficiently.
Whenever I look at this 5-step system, because when you go through it like that, it seems really simple. And whenever you reread the book, because David Allen talks a lot about people who reread the book and then they get a lot of new stuff from it, because he's got so many tips and tricks in the book on how to do certain things and how to think about them. How do you think about the work, the ideas that you're having? And he has so many little tidbits of information that you can read the thing multiple times and get a lot out of it. And one of the reasons I wanted to go ahead and reread this along with you here is that it's been a long time since I've read it. And I've kind of gotten into my normal routine, my normal, I don't want to say a rut, but my normal, what I call GTD, which, you know, going back through, it turns out that I was dead on for the most part. But one of the main focuses that I wanted to have going through this, I guess one of my expectations was that this would allow me to, I guess, get a little more sense of control on what's going on in life, because there's so many different aspects of, you know, just typical how we do and how we live within our culture and our society. You think about, you know, we've got our work stuff, or we have side projects, or, well, side projects don't really exist when you go out and do a solopreneur lifestyle. But whenever you've also got kids, you've got a spouse, you've got, you know, if you're into church, you've got all these different aspects of life. And the longer that you spend with this framework, and the more time you spend with it, it seems like you continue to find more levels that it applies to. At least for me, that's what I continued to find, was every time I would read a next section of the book and he would talk about, you know, project planning. Well, I know how to plan projects. I know how to come up with ideas for that. And this was one of my struggles with rereading it. And I'm terrible at rereading books, Mike. But whenever I reread a book, I'm usually like, well, I already know this. And then I have a tendency to want to skim it. It's like, I don't need to read this. I already know it. Thankfully, I didn't do that a whole lot with this one, simply because I knew he had rewritten a lot of the sections, and he's even got a whole new chapter on the science behind this stuff. And going through the little tiny bits, there were a lot of things that I picked up from it. But some of the simple ones is just, you know, how do you come at an inbox? How do you deal with reference material? And, you know, just those little tiny tips that I guess I'd been skipping quite a bit. I don't know if that makes any sense, but just going through it again, it really reinforces a lot of those habits that have been in place for quite some time.
Yeah, one of the big things that I got from rereading this book, and I don't really want to go in and try to teach people necessarily what GTD is in this particular podcast, because that could be several hours worth of material. And there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet already.
It's true. That could be a podcast, like whole show in and of itself, probably.
Yeah, so we kind of gave you a rough outline of the different tenets of the GTD system, but there's a lot of other places you can go if you really want to get more in-depth on what exactly that looks like. And if you haven't read the book, absolutely pick it up and it's worth reading. But the things that I got from this were filling in the little cracks in the system that I knew were there, but I didn't really know how to solve, I guess. So, for example, he mentioned about how the right amount of complexity is whatever creates optimal simplicity. And in the past, I've been guilty of trying to have one specific thing that I would use for my everything bucket and put everything there. So specifically what that looks like for me, my reference files. I have in the GTD methodology, you basically put everything that you want to keep into a reference file. The problem for me is that I don't want everything that I want to keep in Evernote, even though Evernote could be used for all that stuff. So as I was reading through it this time, it occurred to me that there are different things that I can add to my GTD system, which, while it will make it a little bit more complex, it's actually going to create less friction in actual daily usage. It's going to make it more simple. One of the big ones for me is quotes. And the GTD book is full of awesome quotes. So I was going through there and I wanted to keep like a dozen of them. And I use an app called Quotebook. And so as I was reading through GTD for the second time, I realized that that is completely okay. That is still GTD, that I have a second app that I'm going to store something specific like that. That was kind of a revelation point for me, I guess. Another one that stood out to me was defer dates in OmniFocus. David Allen talks about the tickler file with the folders. Do you do the tickler file?
I do a version of it. That was one of the things. It's like, okay, I'm doing this, but, and so just to kind of get it out there, I do a little bit on a calendar. I've got a Tickler calendar, and if it's like an event that I'm interested in, I'll put it there. But like you're saying with the defer dates, I leverage those heavily in OmniFocus, but I'll let you explain it.
Yeah. So basically, as I was reading it this time, I don't know if he explained it a little bit different in the revised version, but he articulated the reason for the Tickler file, and it's so that you can get the things that you need to see when you need to see them. And he advocates for the physical Tickler file where you have 43 folders. That's where Merlin Mann's famous website got its name. You have one folder for each day of the current month, and then one folder for each month in the year. And so you have the next 31 days, basically you have a separate folder for each one of those things. And then everything beyond that just goes into the month folder. it occurred to me as I was reading this book that that's exactly what the defer dates in OmniFocus do. They make sure that whatever you need to see comes to your attention at the right time that you need to see it. And so it kind of fleshed out for me, if I were to map out all the different apps that I use in my personal workflow, it helped me connect a few dots and fill in a few holes that were there that I never really just took the time to sit down and think about before. But I think that alone was worth reading the book, in my opinion.
So let me ask you a question. So you mentioned Evernote and reference material. Is that where you keep a lot of your reference material?
Yes. Yeah, I keep a lot of stuff in Evernote. But like I said, there's specific things that I don't want necessarily to keep in Evernote, like the quotes I'll put in Quotebook.
Okay. I don't know if you know this. I just completely trashed Evernote.
I did know that. Yeah, I saw you you mentioned that.
So I used to be huge into it and got away from it. It's interesting that you came away from it with the idea that it's okay to have a number of apps, and because I can see how you take that. I took it the other way of seeing that, yes, you could use a bunch of different apps, but simplifying it down to as few as you can get away with would create a lot of clarity. At least that was my perception of it, and that's why one of the things that I want to try to incorporate is, one, a consolidation of inboxes. He talks about, we get too many inputs, too many different collection points. You think about like social media, files, emails, and we got tons of them. Even like my normal checklist of clearing inboxes currently, prior to the book, had I think 12 different inboxes I was clearing out on a daily basis. It's like, this is ridiculous. So one of the things I wanted to do was consolidate those. And some of that requires paring down the number of apps that I'm using. And I was already pretty slim. Whenever I left Evernote, and like, I don't have a central app or structure. I do have a structure, but I don't have a specific app that I use for anything, really. Like, anytime there is like a quote app, or what's the other one? There's one for books that's online. Not going to think of it.
Well, let me interject here, because this was really the tipping point for me, because I agree with you in theory. And really what makes this work for me is that I don't go to Evernote or I don't go to Quotebook to put things in. I put things in on Drafts on iOS. That's my inbox. So that's the key thing. But then let me ask you this, where do you keep your contacts? You probably don't keep your contacts and your phone numbers in Evernote, but that's technically still a reference file. Where do you keep your passwords? For me, it's one password. So as I was thinking about all these things that would technically fall under the category of reference file, it occurred to me that there's no way I'm putting all of that stuff in Evernote. That's not going to be the easiest app to use for a lot of these different applications. When I need to use a password, 1Password makes it really, really simple to find that. You know, but I might actually put it in Drafts to start off with. I might put that phone number or that person's name or email address in Drafts to start with. So the inbox stays the same, but then ultimately where it ends up is going to be different based on the specific use case.
And see, I think that makes a lot of sense. If you're going to have one starting point, that changes a lot of that. Because if you're, in my mind, whenever you're explaining using the different apps, like if I start a new password, of course, for me, it's going to be created in 1Password as well. Anytime I have something like that, some of those have a specific place, like you're saying, but if you have a central collection, like that comes back to the ubiquitous capture process that he talks about all the time. If you got to have a piece of paper, you got to have an app or something that's always with you. And I think if you've got one of those in place and you're collecting into that, not into this other structure, that I get.
Exactly. And there were a lot of, to be honest, a lot of little things like that. As I read through the book, I'm like, I don't know if I agree with you, David Allen, on that particular thing. But it's the way I kind of reconciled it in my mind is, it's not really disagreeing with the principles. It's more so disagreeing with the process that he proposes for some of these things. Like another thing he talked about was an email system, where you have in, you have a folder for action, you have a folder for archive, and a folder for waiting for. I personally don't think that's real efficient. I think you need an inbox. That's where everything goes. And then you've got your archive folder where you put things after you've sent it to the correct place. And the action folder, I don't think you need that. That's what the task management system is for. And then the waiting for, that could be task management also. It could be something like OmniFocus. But in my opinion, something like SaneBox is perfect for this. Because do you use SaneBox, Joe?
I do not. I've heard a lot about it. I've seen a lot of people talk about it. I don't see the point.
Okay, well, maybe this will change your mind. SaneBox has a lot of features. And the big thing that they do is they filter your email so that you only see the things that are important to you. That's kind of their flagship feature. And the way it does that is it looks at the sender's names and the subject lines. It doesn't look at the contents of your email, so it respects your privacy. But the thing I love about it is this BCC feature. So if someone emails me, let's say you email me, and I reply to you with a question about Bookworm. Okay, now, typically what you would do if you were following GTD is you would put a task I would put a task in my OmniFocus to follow up with you in a week, let's say, okay? And I put that in a waiting for context, or I could put it in a waiting for folder in my email. But like I said, I don't really like the folder classifications in email. Then if a week passes and you didn't get back to me, then I can follow up with you. But if you do reply to that email before the week is up, I still have that task inside of my task management system that doesn't know that you've replied to me. So I have to go back and do something with that. With the BCC feature in SaneBox, it eliminates the need to duplicate that in the task management system, but it also doesn't really treat your email as a task manager either. What it does is it will create a reminder for me 1 week from today. If I were to BCC 1 week at SaneBox.com when I email you, if you reply to me, that reminder disappears. If you do not reply to me, in 1 week, that message will appear again at the top of my email inbox. Does that make sense?
It does. I use the online Gmail for all of my email, and I have been heavily using the important indicators that Google has built into that for a long time. And maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just my perception. It seems like I get the same thing. Like I don't see emails that show up in my important inbox very regularly that I didn't want to be there. Like that's just, maybe I've already got it trained to do that, and it's for, you know, whenever you're starting out with email. That could just be me, but
no, I think you're right. I think for the main feature of SaneBox where it's cleaning up your inbox, you're right. Gmail would do something similar, except that SaneBox would work with whatever email
right.
service provider you have to use.
See, I get that. Yeah, if you're outside of Google's domain on that, yeah, I could see where that steps in. But whenever I saw the section that David Allen put in about email, I just kind of chuckled. Like, okay, we're going to go through right. email now. But if you come at it from his standpoint, most of the people he works with are corporate executives. And when you think about that type of role, it seems like most people who, you know, I've worked with some of those guys before. I used to work corporate, and some of my supervisors were in those roles. And the email was what they did all day long. Like that was their work. It was the process of approving things, and you'd send emails and let's get some more, and then I'll read these and I'll send these off. And it was just, that's what they did. And then they had folder after folder after folder of all kinds of things that they could never find. And I tried a lot with them to kind of help them find a better way to organize it. I hadn't really been through GTD at that point, so I didn't have good advice for the most part. But he's got, like you're saying, he's got the different folders that you put things into in order to get to process it and put it in the right place and everything. For me, what I have found, because I use Gmail heavily, is I just grab the link, the URL to a specific email, and drop it in OmniFocus if I need to reply on it, but I'm not going to do it right then. But most of the time when I'm going through email, I just set aside a time for it. And instead of, you know, dropping a task into OmniFocus and then coming back to it later, I just go do them all right then. Like, I'm just going to bust out all of these emails and just get them all done, because to me, if I grab that as a task and I put that in OmniFocus, it's bouncing around in the back of my skull and I might as well have just written it.
Exactly. There's a disconnect there.
It's like, so I get it. I get what he's trying to say. And I think that makes sense for some people, but for me anyway, I can't stop thinking about it unless I'm done with it. So I just know that I'm better off either one, staying away from my email inbox, which is why it sometimes takes forever to get an email back from me. Or two, if I'm going to go open my email, I better get through it right then and just clear it all out as much as I can. Like, those are the two methods that are best for me, and I know that.
Yeah, he talks a lot about email in the new version of the book, and I kind of wish he wouldn't have, because I disagree. Most of the stuff I disagree with centers around how he proposes to use email. Like, he says that he recommends setting up project-based archive and active folders. And I'm thinking to myself, for every project you're working on, you want a separate archive and active folder?
It's going to be a nightmare.
A little part of me died when I read that. There's absolutely no need to do that. And he also talks about, he said, I will often print all potentially useful items pertaining to the subject, spreadsheets, schedules, emails, web pages, etc., to have on hand as reference for those kinds of interactions. And I was like, what? That is a terrible idea. Why wouldn't you use something like at Agent Efficiency? We use Jira and Confluence, for example. Like, it just boggles my mind that someone would go to the bother to print out all that stuff so they have that information at your fingertips when you can use the technology to get that in a second with the search functionality. And I know that he tried to kind of stay away from the technology in this version of the book, which I actually think was a good move. The old version got dated pretty quickly, as he's talking about, I think he references like Palm Pilots or something, and there really aren't smartphones. And so a lot of the principles, while they're evergreen, those technical details quickly date the book. But in my opinion, talking about email, while email itself is probably going to be around for quite a while, his approach to it, I think, is also a little bit dated.
Yeah, he's got a number of places in the book where he talks about, we'll just print this out and then you'll have it when you go there. It's like, no, I don't even own a printer. Like, it's just not, it's not going to happen. But he's even got, and I understand where he's coming from. He's a paper guy. I might be slowly working my way back into that. I don't know if that's good or bad. But there was a section he's got in it. He wrote a page on paper versus digital. And he goes into how he sees paper being superior to digital note-taking in a lot of areas. I would imagine that he's the type of guy that if he's going to print off an email, he's probably drawing pictures on it. He's, you know, marking it up significantly when he's in that meeting. I would bet that's the type of thing that he's doing, and he just doesn't know how to do that. From a digital standpoint, like, there's probably some, I've worked with some people that print everything and it just drives me crazy. So I get it. But at the same time, like, okay, if you're going to talk about all the different technologies and all the different things that are out there that enable this stuff, printing's probably not a good suggestion when you come at it.
And there is, I mean, paper is timeless. And we talked about this actually on your show, the analog versus digital.
Oh, right.
You can use paper to facilitate any sort of system, and then you could apply digital tools to make it more efficient. So it's very versatile. It's very timeless. Like, I get that, and there's a lot of value there. I guess I'm a little bit skewed, and you maybe are too, because what I do for a living is I look for more efficient ways to solve these problems. And so for someone like me who's reading this book, it's kind of smacking me in the face. Like, well, why not just use this tool to solve this problem? But 20 years from now, that tool probably isn't going to be around. Whereas that printed email very well could be, if you have actually a paper-based storage system that allows you to find it again.
Right, right. Now, this is a good segue here, because one of the quotes that I had sectioned off here that I thought was really interesting, because, you know, we've had this discussion before about analog and digital. I'm just going to read this. It's just a quick paragraph here. It's about the tools that are used within GTD. Here's what he says. Keep in mind, though, that the tool you use will not give you stress-free productivity. That is something you create by implementing the GTD method. The structure you incorporate will be extremely important in how you express and implement the process, but it is not a substitute for it. A great hammer doesn't make a great carpenter, but a great carpenter will always want to have a great hammer.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, because how many times do we see arguments or discussions about, you know, Todoist is better than OmniFocus, or, you know, OmniFocus is still better than To-Do. Like, how many times have we seen these articles and stuff come out about, you know, the best task manager out there? I think it really depends on the person. I don't know how many people I've had email me asking for comparisons of, because I write a lot about OmniFocus. I'm a huge scripter, and I'm in it all the time. And I get a lot of emails about comparing OmniFocus to another app. It really just depends on how you want to operate. I've recommended people just using Reminders on their iPhone before, just because that's the one they like and it's the one that works for them. It just really depends on how you want to operate. I even had a guy email me this morning, says he does everything on note cards. It's like, go for it. Like, if that's what works for you and it's what gets it off your mind and you can get stuff done, I wouldn't fight it.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to pick a system that works for you. And the objectives of your system, I want to read these three bullet points basically for, I think he's talking about using these specifically in the review process, but when I read these, it really hit me like, this is the goal of GTD. This is what it allows you to do. Get clear, get current, and get creative. And really what that means to me is get clear, get everything off of your mind, get everything into the system. And then get current, get the system up to date. So look at all your projects and decide, is this something I still want to be doing? And then lastly, get creative. So that kind of ties into the whole concept of like deep work, or if you're a knowledge worker, this is the stuff that's you're actually getting paid to do. You're not getting paid to manage the task management system. This is the goal. This is the point you want to get to. This is when the fun starts. And a lot of people, like, it almost made me sad when I was reading this, because I could picture people in my life that I know are those creative types, and they just are stifled because they feel overwhelmed. They're exactly who David Allen is writing to in this book, and they never get to that third step. So coming full circle back to what you were talking about with the different types of systems, whatever system is going to allow you to facilitate that flow is the right system for you.
I'm going to pivot on you a little bit here. One of the topics that, because part of what I was going or wanting to think about as I was rereading it was, how does this version, because this is the 2015 edition that we were rereading here. And I assume you also read the original version when you first got into it, which is what I did. One of the things I was really interested in was how he approaches contexts in this version as opposed to the first, because that was such a big debate for a long time about, in the new age with mobile technology, with computers that float around in our pockets wherever we go, contexts don't matter. And that's where we saw a lot of people trying energy level contexts, and it kind of got out of hand for a long time of what are all the different versions and flavors of context that can we dream up, because the tools and locations thing just doesn't matter anymore. And it was interesting, whenever he talks about context, he goes right back to the exact same set of default contexts he had in the first book, with calls, lists, office, computer. Like, it was like cut and paste. He didn't really change any of it.
Right. He did actually, did you see, he did actually address the low energy context.
He did. Though. Yeah. He did, at least whenever you get into, because one of the things that's a bit confusing is he does reiterate the whole process again. He goes through it. I don't remember what chapter it is. Chapter 3, I think, he goes through the full steps. Maybe it's chapter 2. He goes through all five steps, and then he reiterates and goes through them all again later. Mm-hmm. And when he reiterated the section on context, he does explain that people have gotten creative with it, and he thinks that's awesome. And I would agree, if that works, go for it. So he at least does address it. The one thing that was interesting to me is that he personally doesn't really step into those at all. He's pretty good about just sticking with the core. And I would tend to stay in that category. I have just found that for me, if I stick to tools and locations, that seems to work really well. I did rethink a few contexts. Like, I had one that was for writing, and I recently stopped writing on the computer. I've started writing with pen and paper. This is why I think paper is probably coming back into my life. I don't know if I want to admit that, but it is something that I'm starting to do more of, is using pen and paper. And whenever I went through that and was thinking about the different contexts that I was using, I had one for writing, but I also had one for analog, which for me was using the whiteboard, using pen and paper, you know, on the note cards, you know, anything tactile or physical is whenever I was using those tools. And my writing context got shifted and consolidated into that analog context. So it just didn't need to be there anymore. Whereas before, it was kind of a breakout off of the computer so that it was a separation there.
Yeah. And I guess my approach to context is coming back to the quote I shared earlier that kind of jumped out at me. The right amount of complexity is whatever creates optimal simplicity. And so while I really like the idea of some of those little bit different contexts, like he talks about in the low energy context, it could be really useful to have a list of things that you can do when you don't have much energy, you know, and he actually puts a number on it. He's like, when your energy level is at a 6.7 out of 10. And right when I read that, I'm like, I am not going to go through all my tasks and decide which ones require a 6.7 or higher on the energy scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so for me, I don't know, maybe there's probably people listening to this who think differently, and they're like, oh yeah, that's not a big deal. When I capture tasks, like, I can put that stuff in. That's takes me an extra 2 seconds.
I'm jealous.
It doesn't work for me. That having to decide that would be enough for me not to capture some things into my system. So I'm not going to use something like that. And coming back to your context of like writing and analog, me personally, I would probably combine as many of them as I could. If writing falls into analog, and analog is the bigger, broader umbrella term, I'd just use that one. So I don't know. As I read through this, I got more ideas for context, but I also, I think, decreased the number of contexts that I'm currently using.
I think I cut 3. Yeah, I cut 3 out of it, and that brought me down to 7, I think. And you know, for me, I'm using tools primarily, so like iPhone, MacBook Pro. I guess it would probably help if I look at it. That would tell me a lot more. I've got one for read. You know, now that we're reading on a regular basis for me, I figured that would be a good idea. I've got one for learn, which is. That's kind of a, I guess if I'm going to have an energy level context, that would be it. Because that one, it's theoretically, it's a low energy, I don't really want to think too hard context. And there's something that I want to research. So it's kind of like a research, mostly distractions, if you will, of things that hit me while I was working on something else. And I want to go look into blacksmithing, or I want to figure out how that specific wood plane works. And like, there's different things like that, that like I'll capture those and write them down. And those usually land on that learn context. I've got one for develop, since I do a lot of code writing. That's just a different mindset that I go through. And then the one of them that I really am glad that I have, I just call it after hours. And that's typically like my DIY projects around the house. I do a lot of the whole house maintenance, and you know, I built a deck on the back of the house, that type of thing. So that's where a lot of those steps land. So I keep a lot of this really simple. I don't want it complicated.
Do you use people-based context at all?
I do not. I have, well, as far as putting a name to it, no. But I've got an agendas context and a waiting context. And that it stops there. Like, I don't, some people like to do the sub-level and put a specific person on it. I just name the task with the person at the beginning of it. And that's it. Because I float in and out so often that it's just, it's easier to do that. And I never have more than like 10 or 15 of them anyway. So I just don't see the point in breaking them out. I mean, that's one thing that David talks about quite a bit is, you know, if you've got a certain number, there's no point in breaking it out to where you've got one on each list. You're better off if you've got like 10 or 15, I think, what's the number? 20, I think is what he said. of if you've got 20 or less, just put them all on one list. Like, don't go through the trouble of breaking them all out. You can just look at them and figure it out pretty quick anyway. So with me, because I'm using OmniFocus, I've got a perspective set up that combines agendas and waiting for whenever I'm going to meet with somebody. And that allows me to see the items for both sets. Does that make sense? So I'm able to see the agendas that I need to bring up, but I can also see the things that I'm waiting for at the same time.
Yep. And to be honest, people-based contexts have never worked for me inside of OmniFocus.
Yeah.
And this is exactly why I use Sanebox. Because when I am going to be communicating with someone, it is going to be most likely via email, or it might be on Twitter. That's basically it. So using the BCC feature on Sanebox has pretty much allowed me to eliminate that waiting for context, at least as it pertains to people. And that has made my system a lot simpler. At least it brings me peace of mind anyways to know that I don't have to go back and forth and keep these things current. I only have to manage it in one place.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, if you've got it just in one spot, go for it. I just find that, you know, if I've got an email that pertains to a specific person that I'm waiting on a response on, again, I just grab the URL and Google and drop it onto a waiting list inside of OmniFocus. Like, that's as simple as it is for me. I have found, Mike, that I'm not so smart when it comes to this stuff, so I just need to make it really, really simple. I just have to grab a link, drop it in, be done. Like, that's all it is.
Can I ask you your thoughts about the chapter on the supporting science?
Yeah, so Mike,
I'm gonna let you go first, and then I'm gonna give you my perspective on this.
Okay, I read it, I get it. He had a lot of good points. He's got a lot of science there that seems to support it. I was a bit caught off guard by some of his choices there. Maybe it's just me and the way I was seeing it. I used to help a bunch of scientists develop these types of studies in some form. So I tend to pick at the exact study itself and try to tear it apart so that I could tell if it's legit or not. There's, you don't want to get me on a rant about trusting science, but I was just a bit caught off guard with the specific studies that he caught. Now, to contrast that, David Allen has also mentioned a couple other books about the science of how your brain operates, and I've only read one of those, The Organized Mind, by Daniel Levitin. I really enjoyed that. It's crazy scientific, and there's a lot of terms that are hard to understand in there. But it was very helpful to see how our brains operate and how do we go about storing information. And he's very good, Daniel Levitin, is very good about explaining how we're not good at storing things in our mind, and how an external system is so helpful. Now, I really wish that David Allen had pulled some of Daniel Levitin's research into this, because I feel like that would have supported what he was trying to say a lot better than what he put into it. And that's just my perspective. I'm sure there's a lot of benefit in it, but I liked that he put in the section about it that shows, you know, there actually is some science behind this, and he does mention a couple books that you can go to get more about it. but I really wanted him to dive into it a little bit more than what he did.
So you mean you wish he would have dove into it at all? I was very disappointed in this part of the book. And to be honest, this was the thing that I was most looking forward to. I heard him talk about how, yeah, we've revised it. We've taken out the technology-based references, which made sense. And we've added a section on the science behind why GTD works. And I thought, great, this is perfect. But what he did is he basically identified six different areas that GTD would kind of broadly apply to. And then he would cite that this person did a study, but there were no specific findings. And mm-hmm. I am not Joel Buhlig. I am not going to go dig up those research reports and read them for myself. But what I was expecting was some specific numbers. I think there was one number in that whole last section of the book. I really like the approach that Cal Newport uses in Deep Work, for example. And it sounds like that's what Daniel Levitin uses in The Organized Mind, where he'll take the research. Maybe he's not doing the research, but actually articulate how this applies. Don't just say, oh, this falls under this category of science, and here's a research report if you want to dig into it more. And he talks about, like, there's hundreds of studies that apply, and every time you go through GTD, you're reinforcing it because, look, science. But he never really explains how. I was really, really let down by that section of the book.
The part that's funny to me about that is the three chapters prior to that one. He's got, what's he call it, GTD and cognitive science. So that's the name of the chapter that we're talking about. Previous to that, he has the power of capturing habit, the power of the next action decision, and the power of outcome focusing. And to me, those three chapters explain what he's attempting to explain in the science chapter, because mm-hmm. those go through why some of the processes in GTD work. Why is it helpful to get things off your mind? Why is it a good thing to ask what's the next action? You know, why is it good to visualize the end of a project and how to plan to get to there? And he goes through a lot of the benefits for each of those. And
yes,
it would have been very easy to just say, and this study supports this, and just be done. Like, just drop it in and say, you know, here's a study that Daniel Levitin and his team did that shows that pulling things off your mind frees it up for more creative thoughts. Like,
right.
He can do that. And there are those studies that exist, and he just didn't do it. And he preferred to put a whole chapter on it, which came up severely lacking both in numbers, and it really wasn't that long either.
Right.
It just didn't. It wasn't real helpful, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. This book is already about three times longer than it needs to be. Once you identify the five steps, you can pick out some additional details and things that might refine some things in your system. But if you were reading this for the first time, if you read like the first 50 pages, you could probably just stop there. So I think this is a huge missed opportunity, because the book is already droning on, and he's saying the same things over and over again. He's saying them different ways, and that's standard. Like, I get that, and I'm okay with that. But then don't take the opposite approach when it actually comes to the science and the research. Don't just gloss over it, which is really what it felt like. It's like, yeah, there's this study. Oh, there's that study. Oh, there's that study. If you would have taken that approach through the rest of the book, there wouldn't have been individual chapters for each of the five steps.
Now, I don't know, because the chapter following the science chapter, is that a new one as well? The Path of GTD Mastery, is that a new one?
It seemed to be new to me. I was reading it on my Kindle, and I wasn't comparing it side by side with the original version, so yeah. I couldn't tell you.
I didn't have the original with me either, so if you're listening to this and you know the answer to that, I'd love to know. But it's called The Path of GTD Mastery, and I don't recall this at all, where he talks about the three different tiers of mastering the GTD methodology. I didn't even know that this was a thing of trying to quote unquote master it. At the same time, he also talks about mastering in the sense of just falling into the grooves and understanding the concepts. And that's what he's calling mastery. It's not that you get to a right. point and you're done and you've got it all figured out. You don't really get to that point. It's more of a, this is a journey that you're on. As long as you're on it and you understand it and you're willing to continue on that adventure, it will continue to get better. And that's what he's calling mastery. And I thought it was interesting. So he's got what is it? The beginner level, the graduate level, and then what's he called the last one? Postdoctorate, I think is what he called it. Postgraduate.
Yes, something like that.
And essentially what he's getting at with those different levels is that when you're at that beginner level, that's when you're quote unquote mastering your runway, or he's calling it ground zero, I think now. He talks about whenever you get your projects and your tasks under control, mostly your tasks, where you've got things broken out by context, you have them by project, and you're able to get your tasks under control, your day and your hours, you're able to stay on task and you can get things done. Like that's what he's calling the beginner level mastery. You get up to the graduate level, and that's when you're starting to get a feel for, and you know, the beginner level is just kind of on autopilot at that point. And now you're starting to make sure that you're working on the right projects and that you are selecting and working on things that take you where you want to go at that level. So it's, I guess it was previously, you'd call it about the 20,000 foot view. I don't know what he's calling that one now, but he gets to where he talks about horizons 3, 4, and 5. And when you master those, that's when he's calling the postgraduate level. I thought it was interesting that because I really hadn't thought about different levels of getting GTD under control, if you will. Like, because I don't know if it's really getting GTD under control as much as it would be getting your life under control at those different levels.
Right.
And it hadn't occurred to me that you can get one level done and under control and not the other. I've always kind of thought about it as a holistic, let's get this whole thing under control. And whenever he brought up these different levels, it's like, okay, so I feel like I've got tasks down, but personally, I feel like I'm just now getting a feel for, am I on the right project, saying yes or no to the right ones and making sure that I'm getting that underway. So it's interesting to me because that would mean that there's another level that I haven't even considered getting completely under control. I mean, I've got those horizons 3 through 5 defined, but I don't really spend a whole lot of time trying to make sure that those are correct. I don't know if any of this makes any sense, but it was interesting to me.
Yeah, I think the way that he articulates it with the three different levels, basically, of mastery, it forces you to locate yourself, and it's pretty much on like a 0 to 100 scale, which again, I'm not 100% in agreement with that. I think that there's some stuff in the top level that I do fine. And then I also think that there's some stuff from the first level that I need to do better on. So that didn't really resonate with me. I get what he's saying. He's trying to say that you've never, like, you can think that you've got this stuff down, but there's always room to improve, I think, is the major takeaway. And then he tries to give some examples of what that looks like, but I don't think it had the intended effect on me that he wanted it to have, I guess, is the best way to say it.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I just really hadn't thought about it that way. It was more like getting it's the same way that he comes at the whole system. He tells you to get your day-to-day tasks and your day-to-day work under control first. And I think that makes sense because if you don't get, you know, the fires put out and you don't get, you know, the craziness under control, there's no way that you can sit down and have a discussion about what's your life mission. Like, you can't have that conversation with yourself unless you've got the dog fed. Like, it's just the way it works. And he comes at this whole framework of let's get the dog fed. Then once we've got the dog fed, we can make sure that we should even have a dog. And then we can consider, should we bring in more dogs? Like, you get the idea here. Is like, you've got to start working your way up, not coming down. But theoretically, you would want to come from top down to make sure that all the runway stuff is the right runway stuff, instead of just, okay, I'm just going to deal with these calls. I don't know if they should be the calls I need to do or not. You've still got to get those taken care of. Otherwise, you'll never accomplish any of it because you...
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of people who need to implement GTD aren't going to do it because they have a bunch of urgent things on their plate. And they're not going to even think about it until they've checked all the boxes. It's quantitative at that point. Even though if you look at it through a qualitative perspective, you're like, yeah, you absolutely need to just forget all that stuff and start thinking big picture. But then that whole section of the book is going back to that quantitative versus qualitative approach. In my mind, that's how I read it anyways, is you check all these boxes, then you go to the next level. And like you're saying, the life vision, that should be in the equation. Maybe not right away. You do have to feed the dog first, so you're not going to have a dog very long. But once you do that, I think it's totally fine to think big picture.
Yeah, I just don't know. Because again, I've got some of those things defined. And I guess I just haven't spent enough time reflecting on those to know if they're the right ones or not. That's the part that was interesting to me with the mastery levels. It wasn't so much that, oh, he defined these now. It wasn't so much of that as much as you do have to start at the bottom and work your way up. And it's just kind of depending on how long you've been at this and how much time you've spent with it as to how comfortable and how, I guess, energetic you are at getting each one of those levels done. I know that I did have someone ask me at one point about how do I trust this system? Because David Allen talks about that a lot, is you have to do this and trust it. Like, you have to put it into the system, keep it up to date, constantly be doing the mind sweep and dumping things out of your brain so that you trust the system. Well, the question is, how do you trust the system? Because that's a lot more difficult than it sounds. You don't just magically trust it one day. And personally, I don't think I fully trusted my system for probably a good year whenever I first put it in place. And I had originally put mine all in Evernote because I was big into Evernote. And I'm a big fan of, if you're going to start doing something new, don't buy a new tool to do it. Use one you already got. So that way I'm not learning a tool and a system at the same time. And what I've come to is whenever you want to trust that system, like, how do you do that? For me, the thing that I always come back to is it takes time and it takes that review process. As much as people hate doing the weekly review, I'm a review Nazi. Like, I just continually say review, 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 review. Like, I just come back at it over and over and over again. I do a daily, a weekly, a monthly, and an annual review. And I'm always, let's go through this thing again. And, for daily, I'm just trying to get inboxes cleared. And weekly is where David Allen spends most of his efforts. And I would resonate with that because unless you are continually dumping your brain of all these things that are bouncing around in your skull, unless you're continually getting things out of your mind and into the system and then working off of that system, which is what he's talking about, I don't think it's until you do that for an extended amount of time that you can get to a point where you just know that everything's there. Because, like, for me, correct, I know that I've been doing this long enough that whenever I sit down to work at the first of the day, I really, like, I know if there's something on my calendar because I've looked at that. But as far as what the exact thing is that I'm going to be working on in the afternoon, I really couldn't tell you until I get there. I can pretty much tell you what my morning is going to look like, and then I reset after lunch, and then I can tell you what's going on after that. But it's not until I get there that I could really tell you what that is. And I think you don't get that trust, and you don't begin to rely on it at that level until you've been pretty persistent at making sure it's completely up to date for some amount of time. And I think that amount of time is probably different for most.
Yep. I agree. The weekly review is vitally important. But for someone who wants to start implementing this now, let me just kind of break down some of my big takeaways from the book, because the things that really stood out to me were the things that I sometimes don't do that cause my system to break occasionally. And one thing he said, which I really, really liked, was there are two essential elements. You need to define what done means, and you need to define what doing looks like. And he refines that a little bit more. He talks about the key question being, what's the next action to move this forward? I think if all people did was start looking at their to-do list and applying those principles, what's the next action to move this forward? And then what does it look like when this thing is actually done? Then you would make a lot more progress on your goals. You'd finish a lot more of your projects. And the thinking component that goes with that to identify that stuff, the thinking and the deciding, that requires energy that most people don't realize. And I'll just speak from my own experience, I guess. The times that I haven't put stuff in my system, or I've put stuff in my system and I haven't clarified that, and then it comes time to do that, having to sit down and figure those things out when I'm looking to do that task is sometimes enough for me not to do it. He has a quote, or a kind of a story in there. He says, it will probably be true that the person who needs tires on his car has had that on his radar for quite a while. It's also likely he's been at the computer hundreds of times, often with just enough time and energy to take that action, meaning find the number of the garage that he's got to take it to. And why didn't he do it? Because in that state of mind, the last thing in the world he felt like doing was considering all his projects, including getting tires and what their actions were. In those moments, he didn't feel like thinking at all.
I know. And that was my big takeaway here, because that is easily my failure in all of this, is that I don't build, because I would call that a trigger list, where it's not a task list. It's a list of things that trigger the memory of a task. And you still have a little bit of work to do. So because you've still got work to do, in your mind, not everything is out of your mind, which is counter all of this. Because you still have that little bit of thought, like you're saying, that's just the little minuscule amount of resistance that it takes to procrastinate over being productive. And that's easily the thing that just jumped off the page at me here, is that I really need to, if I'm going to clarify and I'm going to get things out of my mind, then I've got to do that. Like, I've got to spell out my tasks with enough detail that I can look at it and know exactly what to do. I've got a few bigger projects, important projects that I've been dedicating my time to. And there's certain pieces of those that I just can't get done. And the primary reason is that the thing on the list is either one, too big and it needs to be broken down into smaller pieces, or it isn't actually a thing I can do. Like, I can look at it and it says, finish this project. Like, okay, cool. What's that mean? Like, I don't know. I don't want to figure that out right now, so I'm not going to do anything about it. Like, that's the mentality that I've been coming at with this. And rereading the book has easily been the catalyst it takes to get through that. Enough that, you know, as we're recording this, I just did my weekly review this morning, and it took forever because it was a process of going through every single project and every task, and I think I renamed probably a good 75% of all of them. So it took a long time, but it was sorely needed, because one of the primary results of all of this that David talks about is the clarity of mind and the lack of stress that comes from, I mean, the subtitle here is The Art of Stress-Free Productivity. So it's so true that whenever you get it out of your head and you trust that system, I've already trusted the system, thankfully. And now that I'm able to clarify things with enough detail that I can just look at it and know what to do and not feel any resistance to getting it done, that's the power that comes out of this.
So Should we wrap up and give our action steps, I guess? We kind of did that already. And then our 5-star rating of the book itself.
Sure. So how would you rate this?
I would rate it 4 out of 5 stars. It's a great book. The information in it has made a huge difference in my life. I'm only going to give it 4 stars because in this revised version, I believe that he missed a huge opportunity with the research chapter, and I do believe that it is a bit longer than it needs to be.
That's fair. That's fair. I think I'm a bit torn on the 4 or 5 thing here because, yes, we're nitpicking with the science piece, and it is a bit longer, but I'm trying to come at this that if you were reading this and not the first version, I would probably give this a 5 just because the content that's in here, yes, it's long and it goes through a lot of that, but I think if you're someone who hasn't, like, what is GTD? If I said GTD and you don't know what that is, and I have to explain that it's getting things done and that it's from a book, I think if that's the type of knowledge that you have, or lack of knowledge in this case of this book, this thing will change your life. Like, it literally will. At least it has for me. I mean, I'm recently coming to grips with the fact that I'm ADHD, and this whole framework in and of itself has made so many things possible for me that I never would have been able to do before. So just on that alone, I would give it the 5 out of 5.
All right. Yeah. I definitely see the value of the material, but I guess looking at it through the eyes of someone like my wife, for example, she is much more likely to watch the 45-minute lynda.com course than read this book, which is, I think, probably 6.5 hours, my Kindle said.
Nice. Yeah, I get that. It's hard because this thing is, there's a lot of good stuff here, but you have to be somebody that reads business books. Like, you have to be someone that reads this type of material and like it. Like, my wife would not read this ever. She would not even watch the course on it, but she practices the stuff that's in it, which is hilarious to me. But she, yeah, there's no way she would read this. She'd give it a 0 out of 5. So cool. this is interesting, Mike. So what's coming next? Like, what are the next books we're going to jump into?
I think the next one will be The Willpower Instinct by Kelly McGonigal. And then we've got a few other ones on the docket. I believe you've got one on here, The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, which is a great book. Everyone should definitely read that one. So I'd be definitely okay doing that one in the near future as well. But we're going to try and do one of these every couple weeks. And basically just pick it apart, talk about what we got out of it, and then hopefully other people who are listening to this can kind of glean some of the knowledge and the value out of the books and decide if it's worth diving into themselves.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to, and hopefully, I know, whenever someone else talks about a book that you've read, and, you know, part of the reason I wanted to bring up, you know, the books that we have in the pipeline is that, you know, I'm sure some of our listeners would love to just read along with us and see what our thoughts are on it as well after they've read it. So, you know, if that's for you, go ahead and pick them up, and we'll get to them, I'm sure, at some point, if not right away. But like Mike said, we're going to do it every other week, and we'll keep going from there. Thanks, guys, for taking the time to listen in today, and we will catch you next time.